only ever by Aldous Huxley, read from LibriVox.org by Martin Clifton. Chapter 22. For the sake of peace and quiet, Dennis had returned earlier on this same afternoon to his bedroom. He wanted to work, but the hour was a drowsy one, and lunch so recently eaten weighed heavily on body and mind. The meridian demon was upon him. He was possessed by that bored and hopeless post-prandial melancholy which the Coenobites of old knew and feared under the name of acidy. He felt, like Ernest Dowson, a little weary. He was in the mood to write something rather exquisite and gentle, and quietest in tone. Something a little droopy and at the same time, how should he believe, a little infinite. He thought of Anne, of love hopeless and unattainable. Perhaps that was the ideal kind of love, the hopeless kind, the quiet, theoretical kind of love. In this sad mood of repletion, he could well believe it. He began to write. An elegant quatrain had flowed from beneath his pen. A brooding love which is at most the stealth of moonbeams when they slide, evoking colours, bloodless ghost, or some scarce breathing breast or side. When his attention was attracted by a sound from outside, he looked down from his window. There they were, Anne and Gombauld, talking, laughing together. They crossed the courtyard in front and passed out of sight through the gate in the right-hand wall. That was the way to the green close in the granary. She was going to sit for him again. His pleasantly depressing melancholy was dissipated by a puff of violent emotion. Angrily, he threw his quatrain into the waste paper basket and ran downstairs. The stealth of moonbeams, indeed. In the hall, he saw Mr. Scogan. The man seemed to be lying in wait. Dennis tried to escape, but in vain. Mr. Scogan's eye glittered like the eye of the ancient mariner. "Not so fast," he said, stretching out a small saurian hand with pointed nails. "Not so fast. I'm just going down to the flower garden to take the sun. We'll go together." Dennis abandoned himself. Mr. Scogan put on his hat, and they went out arm in arm. On the shaven turf of the terrace, Henry Wimbush and Mary were playing a solemn game of bowls. They descended by the yew tree walk. It was here, thought Dennis, here that Anne had fallen, here that he had kissed her, here, and he blushed with retrospective shame at the memory, here that he had tried to carry her and failed. Life was awful. "Sanity," said Mr. Scogan, suddenly breaking the long silence. "Sanity, that's what's wrong with me, and that's what would be wrong with you, my dear Dennis, when you're old enough to be sane or insane. In the same world, I should be a great man. As things are in this curious establishment, I am nothing at all. To all intents and purposes, I don't exist. I am just Voxet here that Mr. Scobie elected to sit. He thrived on long temperance somewhat. Consider, for example, the case of Luther and Erasmus. He took out his pipe and began to fill it as he talked. There was Erasmus, a man of reason, if ever there was one. People listened to him at first, a new virtuoso, performing on that elegant and resourceful instrument, the intellect. They even admired and venerated him. But did he move them to behave as he wanted them to behave, reasonably, decently, or at least a little less porkishly than usual? He did not. And then Luther appears, violent, passionate, a madman, insanely convinced about matters in which there can be no conviction. He shouted, and men rushed to follow him. Erasmus was no longer listened to. He was reviled for his reasonableness. Luther was serious. Luther was reality, like the Great War. Erasmus was only reason and decency. He lacked the power, being sage, to move men to action. Europe followed Luther and embarked on a century and a half of war and bloody persecution. It's a melancholy story. Mr. Scobie lighted a match. In the intense light, the flame was always invisible. The smell of burning tobacco began to mingle with the sweetly acrid smell of the lavender. If you want to get man to act reasonably, you set about persuading them in a maniacal manner. The very same precepts of the founders of religions are only made infectious by means of enthusiasms which the same man must appear deplorable. It is humiliating to find how impotent unadulterated sanity is. Sanity, for example, informs us that the only way in which we can preserve civilization is by behaving decently and intelligently. Sanity appeals and argues. Our rulers persevere in their customary porkishness while we acquiesce and obey. The only hope is a maniacal crusade. I'm ready when it comes to beat a tambourine with the loudest, but at the same time, I should feel a little ashamed of myself. However, Mr. Scobie shrugged his shoulders and, pipe in hand, made a gesture of resignation. It's futile to complain that things are as they are. The fact remains that sanity, unassisted, is useless. What we want, then, is a sane and reasonable exploitation of the forces of insanity. We sane men will have the power yet. Mr. Scobie's eyes shone with a more than ordinary brightness, and, taking his pipe out of his mouth, he gave vent to his loud, dry, and somehow rather fiendish laugh. "But I don't want power," said Dennis. He was sitting in limp discomfort at one end of the bench, shading his eyes from the intolerable light. Mr. Scobie, bolt upright at the other end, laughed again. "Everybody wants power," he said. "Power in some form or other. The sort of power you hanker for is literary power. Some people want power to persecute other human beings. You expend your lust for power in persecuting words, twisting them, molding them, torturing them to obey you. But I gather it. Do you not?" warped with an ever-increasing energy, his hands moved in sharp, quick, precise gestures, his eyes shone. Hard, dry, and continuous, his voice went on sounding and sounding in Dennis's ears with the insistence of mechanical noise. In the rational state, he heard Mr. Scogan saying, human beings will be separated out into distinct species, not according to the color of their eyes or the shape of their skulls, but according to the qualities of their mind and temperament. Examining psychologists, trained to what would now seem almost superhuman clairvoyance, will test each child that is born and assign it to its proper species. Duly labeled and docketed, the child will be given the education suitable to members of its species, and it will be set in adult life to perform those functions which human beings of his variety are capable of performing. How many species will there be? Asked Dennis. A great many, no doubt, Mr. Scogan answered. The classification will be subtle and elaborate, but it is not in the power of a prophet to go into details, nor is it his business. I will do more than indicate the three main species into which the subject of the rational state will be divided. He paused, cleared his throat, and coughed once or twice, evoking in Dennis's mind the vision of a table with a glass and water bottle, and, lying across one corner, a long white pointer for the lantern pictures. Three main or when the ideas that were useful a decade ago have ceased to be useful, the intelligences will inspire a new generation of madmen to the new eternal truth. The principal function of the man of faith will be to move and direct the multitude. That third great species consisting of those countless millions who lack intelligence and are without valuable enthusiasm. When any particular effort is required of the herd, when it is thought necessary for the sake of solidarity that humanity shall be kindled and united by some single enthusiastic desire or idea, the men of faith, primed with some simple and satisfying creed, will be sent out on a mission of evangelization. At ordinary times, word.